Okay, so welcome to another one of the Improvise interview series. Today we've got Nick Lee, PhD, from Value Innovations on the line. Hi, Nick, how are you doing?
Nick, very well, thank you. Good to be on.
Good to have you. So the topic we want to talk about today is figuring out what's actually important for your customers. Because this is one thing I have a lot of people I talk to, whether it be clients or other innovation consultants or people in the creative industry. Everyone has ideas about what they think their customers are going to want, and they go out and put out products into the market, and then they're surprised that their innovative, exciting, feature-filled new product or offering just isn't getting the traction that they were expecting. So what I wanted to have a chat with you today about is your view on how you determine what's actually valuable to your customers, whether or not you look at different customer segments, and then we can have a chat about how people can improve their capabilities in this. So why don't you start off by giving us a bit of a background into what you and Value Innovations does?
Let's start off then with the definition of value innovation, which quite simply is to deliver exceptional value to the most important customer in the value chain all the time, every time. And that central piece is to the most important customer in the value chain. So what that requires is that whether you're in B2B, B2C, you need to establish the value chain, develop the value chain, and identify the most important customer. And let me define value chain. It's different from supply chain.
Okay.
So the value chain itself is it's each buying, selling, or using entity between you and the ultimate end user of your product. So if I'm Procter & Gamble and I'm making Crest toothpaste, that value chain is pretty short and sweet. Procter & Gamble manufactures the product. They put it through distribution, which is typically supermarkets and mass merchants, and then this consumer comes into a store and buys that product. If you're talking about being in the chemical industry in the world of B2B, the value chain is much more complex and much longer. But you go through exactly the same process in both cases. If I go back to Procter & Gamble for a second, obviously the mass merchant becomes a critical part of the equation, although Procter & Gamble will argue that their most important customer is Miss Consumer. In a sense, I respectfully disagree with that. Miss Consumer, no question, is an important part of the equation because she is the person who's going to, in fact, buy the product. But there's another very important entity at the mass merchant, and that's the department merchandiser. If you, Procter & Gamble, can't convince the department merchandiser that this is a product that's worth putting on their shelves, Miss Consumer never gets the opportunity to buy it. So there's two parts of that equation.
Okay.
If we go now to the B2B side of the equation, let's take another simple example. If I am a manufacturer of automotive parts, I typically have two sides of the business. I sell to OEMs. That business is characterized by high capital investment and thin margins. But I participate in that business because I want to participate in the replacement parts business where the margins are much, much higher. So for an automotive parts manufacturer, the value chain for the replacement parts business typically looks like this. Manufacturer sells to a distributor. I don't know who the distributors are in the UK. In the US, they may be NAPA, companies like that.
Yeah.
They sell in the US to what are called jobbers. These are small companies, maybe 5, 10, 15 employees in a town. Typically in the UK, you don't have jobbers because distributors can ship parts by truck overnight. And they'll be received at a repair shop or an auto dealer by 9 o'clock in the morning. And then you, the consumer, ultimately buy that replacement part when the repair shop or the auto dealer carries out that repair. So we've got manufacturer, distributor, jobber, auto repair shop or auto dealer and consumer. And the question then becomes, who is the most important customer in this value chain? And we do that using the three questions. These, by the way, have been in use now for about 6 years, and they've worked very, very well. The first question is, if there's a problem with your product, service, or offering, who's responsible for fixing that problem?
And is that, can I just check, is that a problem in the eyes of the end-to-end consumer? Or is
correct.
That a problem?
Okay. Yes, yeah. Let's suppose it's this, that your car broke down outside Nottingham. You limped into a repair shop. The repair shop orders the replacement part for your car. It's the wrong part. Who now has to address that problem? Okay, second question is, if there's a problem with your product, service, or offering, who stands to lose the most financially? And then the third question is, who sees the value? Now, in this example that I've given you, it's crystal clear who that most important customer is. And, Nick, I'm going to put you on the spot here and see if, given those three questions and that value chain, you can now identify who the most important customer is.
It's a tricky one, but, okay, the way I see it, and not being that familiar with automotive breakdowns and everything, but I would guess the people who are ordering the parts and installing them in the people's cars.
Okay. Oh, you're absolutely right. The repair shop is the most important customer in that value chain. And what this does, once you come to that realization, for the manufacturer of those replacement automotive parts, it changes the dynamic for them because they sell to the distributors. So a NAPA or a CarQuest, which tends to be pretty large organizations, the company may be doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business with them, they are responsive, typically, to what those companies input to them. But they probably are not doing an effective job at looking at the needs of, the problems of, repair shops.
Okay.
Is that helping?
That it is. I'm just trying to get it into my head. So if you've got several stages in a value chain,
yes.
What you're saying is most often than not, people are focused, or companies are focusing on what's most important to people directly upstream or directly downstream from them?
Not directly upstream, because those are people who are supplying them with products or services. So it's downstream from them. So everything between you, the manufacturer or the supplier of a service, and the ultimate end user. You don't care about your suppliers. I shouldn't say you don't care about them. Obviously you do. But in terms of identifying the most important customer, they are not on that list. So the first thing we have to do is to identify the most important customer in that value chain. Is it always crystal clear who the most important customer is? The answer is sometimes it's not. And you may come, we use a thing called the three-question template, you may come to the conclusion that there could be two most important customers. In that case, what we advise is that you assume they both are, and then you go out and contextually interview those two groups separately. And when I say contextually interview, people will say, well, are you doing voice of the customer? In a sense, we are, although I cringe when I hear people use the term voice of the customer. We are very specific in terms of what we mean by a contextual interview. There are three of them, three different interviews, carried out with 12 most important customers, and they're interviewed as pairs. So there are six interviews in the first round with 12 most important customers, and we ask open-ended questions. The first question might be, what keeps you awake at night? The second question might be, what challenges do you see in your business over the next 3 to 5 years? So these are very broad, open-ended questions. As you get,
I, I, I get that. I mean, it's always when you're trying to figure out what's most important to people, you get the best insight into what's actually going through their mind if you ask them insightful questions rather than ones that are yes, no, or rate it from 1 to 10, all of those sorts of things.
Right, yeah. Well, if you get salespeople, for example, and you put them out to do this, typically salespeople are relatively impatient people. They're in the business of getting orders, and so their approach to talking to customers is, what is it you need? What is it you want? What changes do we need to make? Those are not the questions you should be asking if you're going to come up with a new product, breakthrough, make a substantial improvement to an existing line of products. That's just not the questioning mode. The second interview that we carried out after we've completed that first round, and by the way, what will come out of that typically is somewhere between 250 and 350 key comments. Some people might call them nuggets, but those 250 and 350 have to be sorted and analyzed. And one of the ways we do that is to use an XLSM file, and we take elements of performance, and I realize there are new terms coming out here, but we take elements of performance from the value curve. The value curve is basically a graphical display which shows you what you need to do to deliver exceptional value. It doesn't tell you how to do it. It just tells you this is what you need to do. So
okay,
the analysis, we come out with an as-is value curve. That's the current state. What do they think about your offering, if you have one, plus the competition? And then with their answers to these open-ended questions, we're getting into the 2B value curve. In other words, what do we need to do to deliver this exceptional value?
Right.
So the second round of interviews now, we're having them critique the conclusions that we've drawn as a result of the first round.
Are those the same people that you interviewed in the first round, or is that a new set?
No, exactly the same set.
Okay.
And basically what they're doing is critiquing the value curve without actually seeing it. We find that you can spend 15, 20 minutes explaining to people what a value curve is. And I'm going to give you an example. We did some contextual interviews with electrophysiologists in Europe and the United States, and we had a pair on from the UK, one in Liverpool, and one just across the river in Manchester. They were absolutely fantastic, but we wasted 20 minutes explaining to them what a value curve was. So we have a golden rule: don't show most important customers value curves. It's wasting those precious minutes that you have with them. But they're critiquing the elements of performance, or if you like, attributes. They're understanding the definition. They're sharing with you the order of importance to them. So if, let's say, you have 12 attributes, you're going to ask them specifically, these are the 12 that we have. We have rank ordered them based on what we heard from you in these first round interviews. Is this the correct order? Is this the most important element of performance or attribute? Is this the second? Is this the third? And if they want to move them, they can, but we'll ask them why. Why are you moving it up or down? So what we have coming out of the second round of interviews, if you like, is a vetted, as-is, and to-be value curve. That's telling us what we need to do to deliver this exceptional value. Then we get into the idea phase. Now we know what we got to do. How are we going to do it? We go through probably 3-4 weeks worth of work to come up with options on how we can deliver this exceptional value. And the last interview, which is in step 10 of our value innovation process, now shares with them these options, and we have them critique them and literally select of, let's say, 3 or 4 that we provide to them. Which is the one that you like the best, and why is that? So there are three rounds of interviews, each 1 hour in length, 12 people interviewed in six pairs, and the same six pairs are kept throughout. At the end of this process, many times these people didn't know each other before this activity. They've become good friends. They've also become part of the process. They feel that they have had a strong influence over what you as a company are thinking about what you're going to do.
No, I think that gives people a good insight into how the process works in a sort of theoretical perfect case scenario. But I think what might help people relate it back to their business is, have you seen any examples where essentially you go in and the company thinks that their value chain is right, but throughout this process they've got some insight that in fact they were completely off the mark in determining who their most important or most valuable customer was?
I will share with you that at least 80% of the time, before people have used this process, they've identified the most important customer incorrectly. And the second thing I will share with you is that this as-is value curve, which is created in step three of the process, and this is done with before the first round interview, which is in step four, that generally that value curve, the as-is value curve, is completely off the mark. In other words, the company's definition of what the value is that they should be delivering is wrong. So the combination of those two things means that many people are doing what you were suggesting up front, that they're going about this the wrong way.
I mean, that's one of the fundamental things that I think companies are slowly starting to realize. The more effort you put in right at the beginning of your development stages, whatever they might be for, product, services, features, warranties, whatever, the more effort you put in at the beginning in determining what's actually going to be important and valuable for the people I'm intending this to be important to, which are hopefully going to be my end customers, it just takes out so much of the likelihood of this not giving you the expected results. So when I talk to people about what I call perceived value, there's certain aspects of what makes up a customer's decision to say yes or no to purchasing a product. And what companies sometimes get wrong is that what they consider valuable to them as a company will therefore also be valuable to a customer at the end. And there's one of my classic examples is, you watch the TV show Dragon's Den, or Shark Tank, I think they call it in the US.
Shark Tank, yeah.
So one of the reasons why people love watching this show, I mean, every now and again they like to see people getting investments for great ideas, but sometimes it's interesting to watch people who've invested significant amounts of time and money into developing a product that they just can't see is not that great and is never going to make them money because it doesn't actually have a viable market. And what they're doing is they're confusing the value that they perceive in it with what the customers might perceive in it at the end. And customers don't look at products in isolation or offerings in isolation. They compare it to everything else that's out there. And when they're determining whether something's valuable, they're going to take into consideration their personal preferences. And for some people, luxury is the most important criteria, and therefore price is not as important. So perceived value, in order for their product or offering to meet a perceived value threshold, it needs to really exceed in quality, luxury, brand, price not being such an issue. But for other people, for other products, price is much more important, and they'll rather buy something that's cheaper, even if aspects like reliability or quality or luxury are not as high. So you need to put yourself in the mind of the, as you're describing, most valuable customer in order for you to increase your likelihood of getting the results that you're hoping for.
Right. Now, this whole demographics thing, especially when it comes to consumer products, which is primarily what you see on Shark Tank, the thing that I find a little regrettable, but I don't see how you sell this on television, is there is no B2B. It's all B2C. But for example, we've done some work with Procter & Gamble on their low-end toilet paper, which is called Charmin Basic. And they specifically wanted to go after increasing share or in sales of Charmin Basic to low-income Hispanics. So the definition right up front for us was most important customer is low-income Hispanic, and that's where we started. And their requirements, as you pointed out, are going to be totally different from high-income families that they probably wouldn't even think about buying Charmin Basic. They're going to be buying either Charmin Ultra Strong or Ultra Soft.
So when you're thinking about the most valuable customer, do you then, is part of this process also looking at how sales are currently going or how essentially an offering is performing? And is there a differentiation that you need to do with people, like in sales or marketing, differentiating between revenue as being the primary value measurement tool, or is that part of the process as well, or not?
It's much less. We certainly use metrics in value curves, but they are not going to be net sales, and they're not going to be gross margin. They're going to show up as a cost or price in that value curve. We've had a recent example of a company called Nautilus. They make exercise equipment. In June of 2012, they were seeing their sales of upright bikes plummeting. They, at that time, had really not given much consideration to the value chain. They had just assumed that purchasing agents or buyers at sporting goods stores were the most important customers. So they were listening to inputs from them. They came to a couple of our workshops, they being the director of product development and the director of product management, came to our workshops and realized that they had identified the most important customer incorrectly. They switched from the purchasing agent at a sporting goods store to the user of the bikes. And not any users. These are serious people who work out religiously. They're probably riding the bike at least 4 or 5 times a week. And they went out, contextually interviewed them. We, by the way, always do this by phone, so when I say go out, that's a misleading term. This is all done over the phone. They interviewed 14 consumers, users of these exercise bikes. They completed the process, by the way, in 7 weeks, which is phenomenal. We typically expect people to do it in 10 to 12 weeks, but they did it in 7. They identified that the first thing they needed to do was upgrade in a major way the cardio control console, and they put in those changes. It took them about 12 months to get that new console developed and in place. The new upright bikes went on sale in September of 2013. In October, November, sales were up 2x. So it was a situation where sales were declining, dramatic improvement in sales as a result of using this process. Long-winded message, I apologize for that, but gives you a sense of what can happen.
I mean, that if I can go into, if I can just query in a bit more detail on that example, where essentially was the incorrect information coming from? So they were talking, they thought the most valuable people were the people in the sales of the either the distributors or however you refer to them. So what sort of information was Nautilus getting from these guys that was actually making the product underperform?
So the salespeople were dealing directly with the purchasing agents at these sporting goods stores. And so the information was being supplied to sales by these purchasing agents. Now, do I know specifically what those purchasing agents were driving in terms of the product? I don't. but I would assume it probably revolved around three things: price, quality, and delivery. So when they went out and started these interviews and collecting the in quotes nuggets, the following things came out: that with your cardio control unit that you have right now, there's only one display. When I'm riding my bike, I like to do one of two things: either put a book on the cardio control unit, because that's the place to put it, or my iPad. There are a series of problems that I have as a result of that. Number one, I can't see the display. Number two, the book or the iPad will fall off. So we need to address this. Nautilus did address this. They now, with their new cardio control units, have two displays. They have a rack in the middle of the unit so that the book and the, or the iPad sits there very nicely and it won't fall off. But it's not covering the second display. That kind of detail will not come out of conversations between your sales rep and the purchasing agent at the sporting goods store.
Absolutely. That's a really good example. I think a lot of people can probably relate that back to their own teams who might be dealing with sort of, especially sales or procurement, are dealing with another large entity within another large company. They might not always be aware of what's important to end consumers on the ground. So that's a really interesting way of thinking about it.
We have a golden rule for people, which is this: if you've identified the purchasing agent as the most important customer, you've probably got it wrong.
Let's take it a step further then. Let's say that a company is trying to develop a new breakthrough innovation or a really disruptive one, which doesn't really have an as-is model within a company.
Right.
What sort of things can they do to prevent themselves getting stuck on missing out the end ultimate value leader?
So they're going to use it
right from the beginning.
They're going to use exactly the same process. Now, of course, they're disadvantaged in the sense that there is no value chain in place. But they have got to make some assumptions about how they think they're going to go to market and who they think the most important customer is. You still have to carry out those interviews with most important customers. At this point, they're not most important customers. They're potential most important customers.
Nice.
So even though it's breakthrough, new to the world, in terms of W. Chan Kim and Rene Morbon terms, it's new market, new product, which is where they expect you're going to find your blue ocean opportunities. By the way, we'll buy that. But what our experience is, there are blue ocean opportunities in the markets you're serving today with even the products that you're selling today. So you don't have to go into this new market, new product space to find a blue ocean.
Yeah. And then finally, sort of taking it to the real extreme, is there a way that that companies can apply this to essentially creating a new market? And, well, I mean, one of my favorite quotes going back all the way to Henry Ford's time is when he was developing the Model T Fords and people asked him, how did you know your customers are going to want this? He said, if I'd have asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said they wanted a faster horse. So at some point, real sort of disruptive breakthrough innovators kind of need to take a punt on what they think customers are going to want at the when it's launched to market, because they have figured out my target customer has these needs, these challenges, and this sort of perceived value, but they might not be able to actually describe that themselves. They may not be aware of it. If the value innovations framework relies on going out and talking to customers and asking them their opinions on those sorts of things, is it still applicable with essentially market-creating breakthrough innovations?
Well, I think the answer is yes. The first thing, by the way, we're not sure that Henry Ford ever said that. We love it so much we use it in our workshops, but we can't find out where he said it or when he said it. But I would describe Henry Ford as a visionary. I would also describe Stephen Jobs as a visionary, Elon Musk as a visionary, but there have been very few of them throughout the history of mankind. They have a unique capability that 99.999% of the population don't have, and they are able to think for themselves about what this new great opportunity is going to be. Does Apple use the value innovation process? We can't confirm that they do or they don't. They certainly don't call it a value innovation process, but we think they use something very similar. There's another company out there called Samsung, and we do know that Samsung uses the value innovation process, maybe in a much simplified version of the one that we use. They brought in W. Chan Kim and Rene Maubon in the middle 90s, I'm going to say 95, 96. At that point, they had recognized that they were the doormat of the consumer electronics industry, and using value innovation and a lot of other things too, have completely turned that company around. So I would, if we're looking at major corporations having an impact on the world today, Apple's there. I think Samsung may be even more impactful than Apple today.
I think Samsung is a great example, especially for what you're talking about figuring out what's actually important to the end consumer.
Yes.
Over the last couple of years, they've been trying to push innovation through features and through differentiation, and this goes through their TV line where they're continuously trying to push 3D displays were the first one that failed, and now curved TV displays are the big 2014 hit of the Consumer Electronics Show. And all the feedback coming out there is that consumers don't really care much for these features. They don't add any additional value over what they get from a good screen at a good price.
Right.
But what they have succeeded at is their last flagship smartphone, the Galaxy S4. When it came out, it had all of these pretty ridiculous features about tracking eye movements to turn off the screen when you fell asleep, or letting you scroll from one web page to another by waving your fingers over the phone. And they made a big sort of show and tell about it when it was first announced. But again, a lot of the feedback they got was that it's all well and good having these features, but no one actually uses them. And so from what I've heard about what's coming on the Galaxy S5, which is soon to be announced, is that they've really stripped down all of these extraneous nice-to-have features and really just focused on things that are really going to be useful day in, day out for the end consumer. Not to say that the specs on this phone are not going to be outstanding and probably world-beating, but they've moved from a let's try and cram in as many high-end features as we can because our engineers are able to produce them, and rather focus on let's get our engineers to produce stuff that the consumers actually want rather than stuff that just looks
good. And by taking out the number of features that you're offering, you're probably reducing the cost of whatever product it is you're manufacturing.
Absolutely. Well, Dick, this has been quite eye-opening. I'd love to find out, is there any way that people can get more information about your framework or about the questions to be asked in interviews or get in touch with you? How can people do that?
Yes, the answer is yes, in many different ways. My email address is dick_lee@valueinnovations.net. They can call me. My cell phone number is +1 720-291-0758. They can find out about our workshops, which are up on our website. Literally go to www.valueinnovations.com and click on workshops. And as you know, Nick, we've just launched two new e-learning courses on Udemy. One is called Introducing the Value Innovation Process, and the other one is called Value Innovation Process Success Stories. And the first one is short and sweet, 5 sessions, 5 videos, about 45 minutes of recording. so not as sophisticated as yours. And the second one, Value Innovation Process Success Stories, has six success stories that we focus on, one of which is the Nautilus case that we talked about. And that's a little longer, eight sections, eight videos.
You're a brave man giving out your mobile phone number for the internet to know, but I guess if it's on your website, then it's exactly the same.
Exactly.
Cool. I mean, thank you so much, Dick. It's been quite eye-opening.
Nick, I really enjoyed talking to you and look forward to continue to work with you as we move forward here. It's great to be with you.
Perfect. Right. Cheers. Speak soon.
Thanks. Bye.